All right, everyone. Today is February 24th, 2015, and this is the Subcommittee on Public Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5542, the Oregon Youth Authority. Ms. Gilbert.
All I have to say is that we are starting on page 57 of the agency's overview.
Excellent.
Good afternoon, co-chair Williamson and Shields, members of the committee. For the record, again, Fairbor Spaksrest, OYA's director. With me today is Dr. Shannon Myrick and Dr. Paul Baladi, who would present some of the material today. But before we get into the presentation, I wanted to answer some of the questions that were brought up yesterday. Representative Wisnant had asked about the county payments. He wanted to know why those two counties were getting, the various amounts. What I found out is that the county funding is basically determined by the number of population, youth between the ages of 10 and 17. So in the case of Umatilla County, it has 20,500 youth between the ages of 0 to 17, 2.37%. of the total population of Oregon in that age range. Klamath County has 14,245 youth, and within that same range, 1.64%. So that's the formula that determines the funding.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Director.
Absolutely. Thank you. Senator Winters had asked about foster care and the need that OIA has. I know she is not present right now. And the list is actually long, but I'll just highlight a few, and then we'll send committee members the list via email. Maybe that has already been sent today. So some of the needs that we have in foster care is bilingual, Spanish-speaking foster parents, African-American homes, Native American homes, LGBTQQ homes for youth who self-identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or questioning. That's the terms for the acronym. And then foster parents who actually have time, extra time, to spend with a younger female population because they do take more time. And then professionals who work in alcohol and other drug and mental health fields that are skilled in working with these difficult populations. So we'll send the complete list to the committee members around that question.
Madam Chair. If I could, I wanted to make sure that everyone that was interested in the OIA budget was also aware that we have introduced a bill, Senate Bill 632, that would create pilot projects, one urban, one rural, that would look to improve the quality of fostering by skilling up foster parents with support and also working on kind of bringing down some of the more challenging behaviors of foster kids. And that's a work in progress. I anticipate it'll go in front of Senator Gelser's committee on March 12th, and it'll probably be amended, sent down to Ways and Means, and see if we can shake loose some money for raising the bar on the quality of fostering in the state.
Thank you so much, Senator Shields. The next question that we were asked to answer, again, was by Representative Wisnant, female population. You wanted to know if there has been an uptick in that population. As we looked over the past number of years, there has been very minor changes over the course of the past few years. For example, last month, our population was 206. Previous year, January of 2014, it was 210. And the previous year, it was 195. Now, when you look at a longer period of time, back in 2002, we had 420 females.
Wow.
2005, we had 259. So there has been a steady and sharp drop. We will send you the entire list for the past 15 years so that you can see how that population has changed both in facilities and field.
Thank you, Director.
You're welcome. Senator Winters had asked for a vocational program for girls. We will send you, it's like 1.5 pages of vocational programs for girls. We'll send that to you in writing. The only thing that I wanted to highlight today is the difference between the female and the male population. Yesterday, the chart that Joe showed on the screen showed that our male population, those who are DOC commit and those who are OYA commit, are almost equal. 47% of our male population in our facilities are adult commits. The difference with our female population is only 16% of our female population is DOC commit. So the age range is lower. For example, from the 61 girls in OYA just yesterday in Oak Creek facility, 56 of the 61 were 18 or younger. So for that very same reason, there's just a differentiation between the age population between the male and the female, and naturally there are more vocational programs that are needed for the male population because the female population is focusing on the K through 12 and getting their high school diploma. Though there are a variety, again, we have 1.5 pages of vocational opportunities, and also because Oak Creek is a transition facility, some of the girls in our transition program have the opportunity to go into the community and get work skills. The next question, again, was from Senator Wisnant, and that was around Family Find program. Just in a nutshell, we know about the Family Find program. We use it. Our parole and probation officers are aware of it. The only difference is because many of the youth who come to us through the foster care program, they already have utilized that service. Yeah. So the number of youth in OYA who utilize that service is far lower than those in child welfare who use it or foster care. But again, to answer your question, we know about it. We're using it.
Question. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Director. So are your probation people trying to find family to connect with them if they haven't had it previously?
Absolutely.
Good.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. One other question that was not asked yesterday but was communicated to us, I think by the co-chairs, was the de-escalation training. If you would like me to, I can speak to that.
I can't remember who was specifically asking about that. Was that me? It might have been one of the others. If you want to hit it quickly,
okay.
It's okay with the chair.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
We actually have a number of different courses, a total of 11 courses that we offer in de-escalation training. I could go through those. We can submit a list of those. We also offer collaborative problem solving. There is a 23-minute video on YouTube produced by OYA. Featuring Dr. Ablon, Stuart Ablon, who's one of the main authorities on collaborative problem solving, and a demonstration of collaborative problem solving by Dr. Whitney Vale, who's our treatment director and a youth in OYA who actually agreed to participate in that session. So again, lots of focus on that. In addition to that, we offer nonviolent communication through volunteers in OYA to our youth, both at McLaren and Hillcrest. I believe those were all the questions. If I missed something, please let me know, and I can cover it or we'll get
questions
it to you.
From yesterday?
Thank you very much for the time and response.
Thank you. And with that, questions we'll get into the next phase of...
And I was not here, so... I was just reminded that you addressed my question and I was not in my seat.
Would you like me to do that quickly again?
Yes, thank
Senator
you.
Senator Winters? Absolutely. You had asked about foster care and the need that we have for foster care in OYA. So what I shared with the committee was that we have about 1.5 pages that we will email to you, but hitting the highlights, we need specifically bilingual Spanish-speaking foster parents, African-American foster parents, Native American homes, and then LGBTQ homes for youth who identify as such and need those specific type of services. We need foster parents who have time to work with younger female population. And we also need foster parents who can focus on alcohol and drug addiction and mental health problems, and have the skill set to working with that population in their homes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Can you also provide us with the demographics of where, when we say foster care, in what part of the state so that we can kind of narrow it down?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator, we have that information and we'll get it to you. So going into the presentation for today, what we're going to be focusing on is the budget notes from 2013 legislative session that instructed us to bring back a 10-year facilities plan and a plan for implementing the youth reformation system and positive human development. Again, that budget note was from the Joint Ways and Means Committee that directed us to do these things. Last January, we submitted a written report on the progress of the youth reformation system that it included business efficiencies, maximizing asset utility, and effective use of taxpayer dollars. That's language from the budget note. Creating a timeline and a project plan, a plan that actually does not compromise the safety and security of youth, staff, or the community, and to the greatest extent possible avoids layoffs. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Shannon Myrick, who will go over what we have done in implementing this system and what is ahead.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Williamson and Shields. For the record, my name is Shannon Myrick. I'm the Strategic Initiatives Manager for Oregon Youth Authority. I've been with the agency for about 7 years. I began in the research unit, starting with a lot of these concepts, and now have the pleasure of leading the initiative to implement the youth reformation system and positive human development. And I'm also have the pleasure of being an adjunct instructor in the Department of Psychology at Portland State University. So it's a really nice opportunity to bring a lot of my expertise into practice. As Fairbors mentioned yesterday, the youth reformation system has four components, and we want to spend just a little bit of time briefly discussing each of those components, specifically the major accomplishments and momentum that we have as we've implemented the youth reformation system in the past year. And I'll start with the population forecast. The population forecast is designed to help us understand what youth are coming into our system more deeply. And we've made some progress here, namely with the short-term forecast, where we've partnered with the Office of Economic Analysis to implement and automate a short-term forecast, which is designed to give us an idea of bed need today. And we're also working on a longer-term forecast, which my colleague Dr. Bilotti will be speaking about in a little bit, so I won't go into too much detail around the feeder system data as the source for that long-term forecast. But it is designed to help us understand what our needs are going to be in, say, 7 to 10 years with respect to services required for youth coming into the juvenile justice system. For the placement and treatment component, the second component of the youth reformation system, we have made a significant amount of progress in implementing some of these concepts. And the major accomplishment is the implementation of what we call predicted success rates. And we're pleased that we're engaged with over 30 counties in Oregon in using this data in a pilot fashion right now for youth coming into the juvenile justice system. And I'll talk with you a little bit more about what that means in a few minutes when we have what Joe referred to yesterday as some role play activities around some cases, some composite cases. We've also made quite a bit of progress developing tools to understand youth's risks and needs. Particularly, we understand recidivism in a much more sophisticated way using what we call the OIA Recidivism Risk Assessment. We call it ORA, and it gives us an actuarial assessment of a youth's likelihood of committing a felony within 3 years of commitment to probation with OIA or release from an OIA closed custody facility. And we're also able to predict an actuarial risk score for violent felony crime as well. We've made significant progress on what we call our typologies, and again, I'll show you some examples of those in just a moment. But we have 6 typologies for our males and 4 typologies for our females. And those are designed to give the frontline worker a comprehensive look at what that particular youth presents at the time that we're seeing them. We spent some time looking at what our research and data tell us in Oregon about optimal length of stay. Fairbors mentioned yesterday that there's a lot of national information out there about what the optimal length of stay is. And we're looking to our information through the Juvenile Justice Information System in Oregon to really understand how long do we need to keep youth in order to maximize our reduction of their recidivism risk and maintaining public safety. We're also thinking a lot about transition in the placement and treatment component of our work.
Namely, we're looking at what we call a transition readiness assessment that's designed to help us understand when a youth can be safely moved to an environment of less restriction, where they will be more likely to be successful and not run from a program like we heard about yesterday, for example. And we also have, with our field services, a pilot of transition JPPOs, which is a juvenile parole and probation officer. And that individual is designed to work with the community, and we have two pilots in Lane County and Southern Oregon, to work with the community specifically around the educational and vocational needs of our youth who are transitioning out, to help reduce some of the things that we know to happen at the time of transition. We're also very proud of the national partnerships that we've forged in the last few years. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about the folks that we've been working with around these concepts. The Council for Juvenile Correctional Administrators, which was mentioned yesterday by our director, the National Center for Youth in Custody, the National Youth Screening and Assessment Project from the University of Massachusetts Medical School, Results First, Urban Institute, Johns Hopkins. And we've been asked to host, in the last year, some technical assistance webinars around components of the youth reformation system that other states were able to apply for and did receive. We provided technical assistance to Texas, Idaho, and Massachusetts, and continue to have ongoing relationships with them as they develop some of these concepts in their state and work toward implementation. Are you ready for some role-playing scenarios?
As ready as we'll ever be.
I'm glad. I am too. I came ready. So I do want to say it's important to note a few things about what we're about to do. And one is that these are composite examples. They do not represent a single case. They do not represent a single youth. They are used for illustrative purposes around the data that we have and what that tells us. And second, because the assessments that we use are drawn from treatment-related data, it's not technically public record, it's protected information, but we're going to walk through some examples today of these composites so that you can see the types of information that we have available. And the first story I'd like to tell you about is Marcus. Marcus is a 14-year-old male. He's currently living in a community that does not have a lot of juvenile justice resources available to work with youth coming into the system. When we look at his history, he's got a moderate history with the juvenile department. He's got some referrals for some pretty serious things: burglary, assault, and possession of marijuana. Marcus's family, though, seems to be very stable. They're very supportive. They're working collaboratively with the team that's charged with his case at the juvenile court. He has current involvement with a county drug and alcohol program. He's currently engaged in individual and family counseling, and he has a juvenile court counselor assigned to him. He's currently a freshman. He's passing all of his classes. And he historically has enjoyed playing sports, including basketball and baseball, but he's recently increased his use of substances, and he's skipping school on a pretty regular basis. And I bring this case to you today because he recently received a referral to the juvenile department for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and driving under the influence. And what this is a process that happens in several counties all over our state. It's called a resource committee or a staffing committee, where a local probation officer might be bringing a case in front of a group of professionals, mental health professionals, juvenile court professionals, OYA, to think about what the next set of steps might be for this particular young person. So if we are pretending that we are that committee, what might you suggest? Should we work with Marcus in county probation? Should we consider an out-of-home placement with OYA? Or should we think about a commitment to an OYA close custody facility?
Anyone?
Okay, I'll take the first one.
Great. You serve on county probation?
Yes.
Great.
Why?
Well, he did a couple of things that are pretty substantial, but he has been in some treatment program, and hopefully that could continue. The other thing is this family's fairly stable, and so I think it's possible to start there.
Good.
and use community resources rather than sending him off to a close facility.
I'm just moderating the discussion. Come on, guys.
Sorry, so they might be warming up with the first scenario here.
But that's with the understanding that, he actually is engaging in the alcohol and drug treatment,
right,
to address the substance abuse issue that he has. So also I think with the understanding that there is a closer engagement with the family in this process, so that we're making certain that you have them involved as well as the counseling. So I I think from that standpoint, as your mental health and alcohol and drug professional, I would want to make certain that you give me the adequate resources that I need with which to provide that treatment.
You know, the assault case bothers me. But here's a 14-year-old and has limited services in the community, and he has his first DUI. And I can assure you, as a state representative, I get one a month of parents can't understand why their son three strikes and he's no longer allowed to drive. So I'm worried about this young man's future. He may need a little tougher slap on the wrist or something than just.
Well, Chair Williamson, your committee definitely passes the juvenile justice employment test. If should this not work out and they need opportunities.
Oh, cool. This is great.
You know, in a pre-YRS world, we would have had some what we call risk assessment information, and the process that you just went through is exactly what our professionals will go through. They'll evaluate these very specific components of a particular case. So we're taking a close look at the lives of young people. One of the tools that we have available that I mentioned earlier is what we call the typology, and this gives us a really high-level overview of the types of needs that Marcus has. And what you'll notice at the very top is a set of lines. Those red lines we would consider need or risk factors for this for a young person who falls into this typology. And the green lines are protective factors. The length of the line is an indicator of how intense that factor is for that young person. So what we want to see is long green lines and short red lines. Additionally, we provide our staff information about case plan strategies that are going to work well with a youth who falls into this typology, and good treatment approaches that can get this youth engaged right away. So you picked up on a couple of great things that were happening for this young person, which we certainly see in those long green lines. However, the increased substance abuse and driving under the influence is definitely something that we want to pay attention to. In a pre-YRS land, or world, I should say, those risk assessments would have been the juvenile crime prevention assessment. It's used at the county level, statewide. It's got great reliability. What it tells us is a youth's risk for re-referral to the juvenile department. And we would have known right away that Marcus has a high risk for re-referral to the juvenile department. We would have also conducted, at the point of considering for OIA involvement, the OIA risk needs assessment, which would have told us, again, high risk for recidivism. So we've got some information. We know things about Marcus, and we know he's high risk for re-referral and high risk for recidivism. But one of the benefits of the youth reformation system is we're getting richer information. Namely, that actuarial risk tool that I mentioned a few minutes ago. We call it ORA, the OIA Recidivism Risk Assessment. That tells us that kids like Marcus have a 23% chance of committing a felony within 3 years of commitment to OIA probation or release from close custody. So a 1 in 4 chance, for example. We also know, as we just covered, that he is a typology E, that he's got some needs that need to be addressed, but he also has some protective factors in his life that we can capitalize on as a system to keep him engaged. And then we have what we call the predicted success rates. And this is where we have an estimate of how likely kids like Marcus are to be successful in three primary settings: county probation, OIA community placement, and OIA youth correctional facility. So, Chair Williamson, Representative Gorsuch said, I think that this youth should be kept at the county. He's got some good things going for him, and I think the data support your decision. Well done. What this tells us is that he has a 72% chance of being successful if we keep him on county probation, a 74% chance of being successful in community placement, and a 43% chance of being successful in a YCF. It's important to mention that none of these data points should be driving the decision. We think about it as a host of information that informs professional discretion, that allows us to think as comprehensively as we can about very complex cases. And you might say, well, why wouldn't you just go with the one with the highest estimate? Well, 74 and 72% are so close, it's indistinguishable. So county probation with a supportive family, that might be the decision that makes sense. And at the end of this resource committee, that committee makes a recommendation to the juvenile court judge. And that judge, of course, gets the final say. But we certainly have a lot more information about the services that we have available that might work for a particular youth than we did prior to thinking about things in the youth reformation system.
Representative Gorsuch.
So on the OIA community placement, is that like the foster home situation that we've been talking about?
Chair Williamson, Representative Gorsuch, yes, it's okay. Out of home placement is a residential program and foster care as well.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are we warmed up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'd like to talk about Sean. Sean is a little bit more of a tricky case. He's a 17-year-old male, and he currently resides in a community that has a lot of juvenile justice resources available to help youth coming into the system. He has a pretty lengthy history. He has 12 referrals to the juvenile department, resulting in 3 formal probation supervisions, and all of his formal probation supervisions are for property crime. He's currently residing with his grandmother and 3 younger siblings in a 3-bedroom apartment. During his freshman year, he was kicked off the football team for attending practice under the influence of alcohol. And he does have a history of mild depression that he reports started after his mother became incarcerated. Sean is coming before this committee with a new referral for carrying a dangerous weapon and possession of a controlled substance. When we ask his teachers, his peers, his friends about him, everyone reports him being funny, engaging, and sociable. So again, we have 3 options: county probation, OYA community placement, and OYA youth correctional facility.
And if I may, you said dangerous, not deadly. In terms of the weapon?
Chair Williamson, Representative Gorsuch, I said dangerous.
Okay, thank you.
Could you read that sentence again? I was taking notes and missed it.
Sean is coming before the County Resource Committee with a new referral for carrying a dangerous weapon and possession of a controlled substance.
Well, you said there is a lot of juvenile support there, or justice support. So I would, he obviously isn't working out well staying with Granny. So I'd move him out of there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd lock him up just yet. But.
Just yet.
I would concur with that.
What was the controlled substance?
Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, I do not have that information available.
The log is between dope and methamphetamine.
Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, for the purposes of exploring this, let's say methamphetamine.
It's meth?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator?
He needs real big time help. As a violent drug, he could become violent very easily. I would say he probably needs to go to corrections and really get some intensive help.
I'm kind of with my senator, because this individual, one, he has a mom now that's incarcerated, which also adds. 2, he has, it appears, some mental health issues with the mood. 3, he has some definite drug issues. 4, he has the weapon. And grandma can't control these. And you didn't say whether or not he's involved with the gang and what the peer group is about. So is he also a part of a gang?
Chair Williamson, Senator Winters, we have not gathered any confirming information about gang membership.
Madam Chair, and then the part about him being sociable raises a bit of a red flag to me also. It seems like this could be somebody who could be kind of on the spectrum of antisocial personality disorder if he was a year or two later. Now it might just be diagnosed as conduct disorder.
Mm-hmm. Great. Shall we take a look at his typology?
Yes.
Ooh. Sean.
Yeah, we were right.
You clearly heard me say that right. Red line is good. So Sean definitely falls into what we would call our typology A profile. So he has a host of need factors, which you all picked out of the very short description that I provided of Sean. And he has very few protective factors. And it's not surprising that he has alcohol and drug is at the top of that list, as well as aggression and attitude issues. And we're definitely seeing that in his history that was presented as a case study. In a pre-YRS world, again, we would have had a couple of assessments that told us some additional information, high quality assessments. The juvenile crime prevention assessment would have suggested that he's high risk for re-referral. With 12 referrals, that shouldn't surprise us. And our OYA risk needs assessment would have said high risk for recidivism. When we take a look at the YRS data, he has a 42% chance of committing a felony within 3 years of commitment to OYA probation or release from OYA close custody. We do know that he is among the more needy and intense need profiles for our young men.
And his predicted success rates would suggest that he has a 50% chance of being successful if he's maintained on county probation, a 65% chance of being successful if he goes to an out-of-home placement with OA community placement, and a 70% chance of being successful if we serve him in a youth correctional facility. So seems like some of you were spot on about needing to be removed from the home in some capacity with higher chances of success in an out-of-home placement or youth correctional facility.
Just quickly to add to this, I just want to reiterate what Shannon said earlier, and that is the scores do not drive the decision. In fact, our principle for making these decisions is the least restrictive setting when possible, and those numbers are pretty close. So depending on the professionals who know the youth and, you know, the resources available in the community, I think the youth could end up in either one of these places. I just wanted to reiterate that. Same thing I said yesterday, we do not make youth into numbers.
Yeah. And I would just also say that I don't know what he was told the last time. Is this your last chance, or we're going to do something? If he's told that, they need to do what they've promised. Because I've seen years gone by, I've seen so many times where kids were threatened and nothing was done, and so then they're going like, shh. Doesn't make any, you know, it's just a bluff and I don't care. So that would happen.
Good. Yeah. Yep. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Bilotti, to discuss the progress on program evaluation and community context.
Thanks, Shannon. Co-chairs, members of the subcommittee, my name is Paul Bilotti. I'm administrator of research and projects at the Department of Corrections and research manager at the Oregon Youth Authority. And so with these two previous examples that Shannon provided, essentially what we're doing is providing predictive analytics, or using predictive analytics and professional discretion to make some decisions. And so we can do the same thing when you're talking about programming that are offered to the youth, both within OYA care and outside of OYA care. And so the program evaluation continuum, which is the third and the fourth component of the four components in the YRS, provides feedback to those that are making the key decisions, the programs themselves, OYA, OYA partners, and to a certain extent, legislators. And so the idea is to provide information similar to what you've seen here to the programs so that they know how well they're doing and how they can improve. From the OYA perspective, the things we need to be able to do is quantify the effectiveness of programs and also know whether the programs that we offer reflect the profile of needs that the youth have. And so if we can quantify that, we'll probably never get completely there, but the idea is to move in that direction. So the current methodology that we've been using for a number of years to quantify the effectiveness of programs, you've probably heard this before, it relies heavily on propensity scoring. And it's been tested for about a decade or so. And we've had conversations with our partners up at the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. They've added suggestions. And they actually now use the same methodology or very similar methodology when they're responsible for evaluating their programs. And so there's no doubt that the statistical basis for the program evaluation continuum exists. The experimental design exists. The issues associated with the program evaluation continuum have to do with how quickly we can respond, basically, and how many studies we can actually conduct in a given year. And so a researcher might be able to do four or five or six of these in a given year. We've got dozens that are out there. There's no way we can continue just to evaluate six or seven and quantify the effectiveness and know whether we're doing a great job serving youth here in Oregon. And so in addition to the mass number that we have to be able to quantify, we also have to be able to provide feedback to the programs and to OYA to know how well we're doing. And right now, if you start a program, it's going to be up and running for a number of years, and then there's going to be a period where we look at recidivism. And here in Oregon, it's about 3 years if you're looking at recidivism. So a program's up and running 4, 5, 6 years. There's an evaluation done. If it's deemed ineffective or marginally effective, what happens is usually there's changes made to the program, and as a result, it continues for a number of few more years, and then we do another evaluation. And we can't afford to have 8 or 10 years of a program before we can make definitive decisions on whether we're going to continue it, whether we're going to modify it, or whether we're going to eliminate it. And so this continual feedback is necessary for us to know how effective a program is. And so if we're actually going to provide quantify the effectiveness of many programs and provide the feedback, we have to automate. And so the only way to automate really nowadays is probably through a data warehouse. And DOC has developed this data warehouse about 12 years ago, and part of the data warehouse today, there's testing to quantify the effectiveness of programs, and it is automated. And so what OIA intends on doing is to actually tap into that resource and leverage what's been done. And so the intent is to build a complement of a data warehouse on the OIA side so we can leverage what we've got and actually evaluate a number of programs or quantify the effects of programs, as well as provide feedback to the programs, OIA, and the legislators. So when this is complete, OIA views this as pretty much the sequel to Senate Bill 267. Senate Bill 267 was intended to look at fidelity and cost benefit. In addition to those two components, what we also need is to quantify the effectiveness of programs, assure service matching is occurring. We have to know whether our services match the youth needs, and we have to look at the service gaps. And so the program evaluation continuum will allow us to do that. And so over the next few years, we'll continue to try to automate this and develop the program evaluation continuum. And basically, it's a fairly simple concept, just to use predictive analytics to improve the decision-making. It's that simple. So that's the third of the four components.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Paul, I think it's important that when you're doing that kind of research on outside programs, that the program that you're doing the research on is working with you hand in hand, has a chance to provide context to any of the numbers or poke holes in your work. Is that happening at OIA, or do the community programs have a chance to provide feedback to the research before it goes to the director's office?
Co-chairs and Senator Shields, yes. There's a conversation before any analytics are provided or information is. The logic behind that is exactly what you cited, where they have the opportunity to add to the model. If there's particular concerns, they have that ability to do that before the analysis occurs. And so the best way to do that is a collaborative effort between the programs as well as the researchers. And to be quite honest, the effort has gone quite well, both at OIA. It's gone well at DHS with some of the BRS providers. And it's gone well because they're open for being evaluated, which might sound a little surprising, but they don't have any other ability to know how well they're doing. They're doing the best they can, and they want to know how effective they are. And so as long as we support them and provide the tools that they need to improve, this should work. Okay, so that's the program evaluation continuum. That was the third of the four components. The fourth component is known as the community context. And so the first component is the forecast. The second component is placement and treatment. The third component is the program evaluation continuum. And the fourth is the community context. And then the underpinning of this is positive human development that Shannon will talk about in a minute.
Hold on 1 second. Senator Bates.
I just wanted to ask a question about, from my mind, the two most important things of measuring your program would be to ask two questions. You may track this information or you may not. If you do, I'd sure like to see it. What percentage of the prison population in the state of Oregon was identified at one time or another by OIA? Is it 5%, 50%, 75%? That would give us some idea of what's going on there. And then the opposite of that, what percentage of OIA youth have gone through any of these programs reoffend in the first 5 years after leaving the program? Okay. That's pretty state. I mean, that's not real complicated numbers.
No. So the recidivism rate it depends on whether you're talking about OIA youth or YCF youth, which are those that are essentially in closed custody, or the probation. But depending upon what population you look at, I'll get you the exact numbers. If you look at the 13 years after leaving OIA, about 57% of the OIA youth wind up in corrections. Now, of the 57%, 44% wind up on probation, and another 12.5% or so wind up incarcerated. So of those that move to adult corrections, most of them wind up on probation, felony probation. So we do know that.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. I would think that's your main track here. Are these people getting back in trouble or not? And at 57%, I appreciate the honesty, but it just tells you how difficult the system is that you're working in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Well, it seems like we're making a huge investment, and we're investing in people's future. Are we looking at ways to improve that?
Yeah, and co-chairs, representative, what we're trying to do is provide information back to the programs so that we know how effective they are and actually target youth populations for particular providers. Some providers do a very, very good job with particular kinds of kids, for instance, typology A or typology E. And so the service matching component of that allows us to do that. And so that's being implemented at this point. Both at OYA and at DOC, they're starting that effort also. And so it's a more efficient use of the same resource. And the idea there is to also look at whether the services we have are well aligned with the youth needs. Every agency that's out there now tries to do the best they can. If you can quantify that, you can actually start moving the line forward and assuring basically that our resources are well aligned with the youth needs. And so I think there's a lot of things that are going on that are associated with the Youth Reformation System that allow us then to do a better job with the resources we have.
And if I might just briefly add to that, co-chairs and Representative Krieger, that's a great question. And the entire intent behind this system is to reduce that recidivism number. And as good or bad of those numbers might look, when you compare that to the national average, we can actually see much higher rates in other states. Our three-year recidivism rate is about 28%. You go to a place like Hawaii or Louisiana, you're talking anything between 60 and 80%. So as Senator Bates, he's not in the room right now, but as he mentioned, this is tough work. And yes, it's a major investment. And what we're trying to do with this system is using data and science in order to reduce those numbers as much as we can. And, you know, that example that I shared with you yesterday around runaways, it is important to understand where the failure occurs. And the major part of failure, as we know, is, you know, going back home or not having enough support, not having enough resources. That's the hypothesis that's in front of us, and we're trying to test it with these systems. Thank you.
One thing further. I've been involved in the dependency issue a lot for 14, 15 years. What percentage of your people in the Youth Authority and your programs are coming out of foster homes? Because a large percentage of those, I understand, end up in the correctional facilities as adults.
Representative Krieger, Paul is going to talk about that right now. The feeder system analysis that we're doing is highlighting exactly what percentage of youth are coming from which programs into OYA.
Senator Shields.
Thank you. Paul, in another budget, we've been hearing about the challenges at the parole board about doing assessments on sex offenders and tiering them appropriately, with the notion being that static 99 is only validated for males, not for women, not for kids. Are we close to finding a validated assessment for juveniles, or is that just, there's just not one there and we just need to take that and deal with it?
Co-chairs, Senator Shields, we just had a group out from Johns Hopkins, the Urban Institute, the University of Wisconsin, and my counterpart in Minnesota. And they've looked at what's known as machine learning, which is the most advanced technical statistical techniques we currently have available. And they compared 12 of those with the existing analyses that we have that we use today. And to be quite honest, I don't think we have a validated tool that will identify those that are highest risk and will sexually recidivate, either in the adult system or in the juvenile system. We just don't have that.
Okay.
That's my personal opinion.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to have to get into the community context pretty quick here, so I think we're a little bit short on time. And so Oregon as a state is data rich. Even though we might have some archaic data systems, there might be data reliability issues. When you compare Oregon to other states, we have a lot of data. And a lot of the data has not been mined within an agency. But there's actually more data between or among agencies than within. And so most families and most youth access more than one service. And yet when we look at our data, we look at what's in our silo. And unfortunately, there's probably more information outside our silo quite often than what's inside the silo. And so the community context component of this allows us to look at that. And I just want to make sure we've got data agreements with a number of agencies, including the Department of Corrections, DHS, OHA, Education, Employment, State Police, and the Juvenile Departments, and data have been exchanged. But there's a reason why we haven't historically done that, and that's confidentiality issues that are associated with the families that get these service. And so I just want to let you know that we're not going to compromise that for predictive analytics or anything else. So that has to be maintained, and that's paramount. There's actually three components to the community context. There's the feeder system, there's the mirror image of that, which is the transition, and then there's the community solutions. And the feeder system, we've spent more time on that than anything else, and Dr. Margaret Braun in the back has been responsible for most of this. But basically, we're asking three questions. Are there opportunities to divert individuals from coming to OIA? And the answer is yes. If we're going to introduce prevention services, do we know the client populations where we're going to be most effective? The answer is yes. And the third question deals with what kind of services should we be providing, and that will be answered in the next year. And basically, what we need to find out there are the family and youth characteristics that increase the risk of coming to OIA. And so Margaret's going to be working on that, finishing up this year, and next year we'll move on to the transition and then the community solutions. And the transition looks at where these youth wind up after they leave OIA. Do they wind up on child welfare caseloads as parents? Do they access mental health and so on? And so we need to know that. And there's two parallel analyses occurring at the same time, one at OIA and one at DOC, and to look at both the feeder systems as well as the transition. The community solutions part, some of the best solutions to community issues lie with the communities themselves. And so the state agencies can benefit from some of our capabilities and our data. And when you have reformatted data and analyzed data, the next piece is actually to provide the information to the communities. That's a very small effort when you look at the total effort. And so if there's communities that frequently access the social service continuum, providing the information to them so that they can make informed decisions is crucial also. I'm just going to go through the next things we're going to be working on real quickly, some of which you've seen. The dynamic risk assessment right now, actuarial risk assessments are heavily reliant on static factors. And usually we know what the risk is at the beginning or the end of a placement. But we don't know how well an individual is doing during that placement. We want to recognize accomplishments that have occurred during that placement, and it recognizes that. We can track change and a number of other things. Measure and track positive youth outcomes. We've relied on recidivism for a long time. It's time to broaden the outcomes and look at other things that are important to the youth authority also. Develop metrics to assess YRS implementation. You use your speedometer and gas gauge when you come here and when you leave here. We need the same things as we implement. And so there are metrics that are going to be developed for the implementation of the YRS systems. Identify the major service gaps. We've talked about that a little bit earlier. You saw Marcus and Sean, and we saw the predicted success rates for those two individuals. For some individuals, the predicted success rates are low across the boards, across the board, and low across all residential treatment facilities. Those individuals are poorly served with existing resources, and we need to do a better job of finding out who they are and then developing services for them. And continue the feeder system to identify opportunities. I've talked a little bit about that. Clearly, we need both the data warehouse to automate the program evaluation continuum and finish off the feeder system this year and get that information out to the different agencies.
Madam Chair,
Senator Winters.
The last bullet, and I probably have talked about and talked with Fairbrows and staff a lot. You know, we constantly react or have to react when somebody has already into the system and what they need to do in order to bring them back into the community. And, you know, this continue feeder system study, which will help us to identify those opportunities early on. And so I'm very, very interested and supportive in the continuation of that work, because we have to remember that the youth that are come to OYA, whether it's through probation or whether they're in custody, in close custody, that they come from a community and they may or may not have gotten what they needed at that level. Part of this, part of what you will see in this particular study, and I hope that it's shared with members of this group, you will see the contacts that these youth and families have had with other parts of our system. And, you know, it begs, and, you know, I've always had the question, you know, it's not as though suddenly it's, oh, my gosh, they just show up at OYA. But they have been someplace else in our system. And does this afford us the opportunity to begin some of our work early on so that we can avoid the close custody and some of those issues? So I, you know, would very much appreciative of the work that's being done by OYA.
Thank you, Chair Williamson and Senator Winters. Senator Winters, thank you so much for sponsoring this effort. I want to briefly address specifically what Representative Krieger asked about contact with OYA, and we can actually email all of you the two papers that have been written by Dr. Braun, who's in the room, who's done this work, about OYA youth with a comparison group. So OYA youth, meaning youth who came to OYA, other youth who did not come to OYA, contact with alcohol and drug treatment services, OYA youth 43%, other group 8%. Foster care youth specifically asked for 22%, other youth 5%. Mental health treatment services, OYA youth, 50%, other group, 20%. This gives us some preliminary understanding of what we need to do early on in order to provide services to families and children so that we can divert them from the system. And again, these are the highlights. We can email you both of the papers, which includes many more details. Shannon?
Just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the positive human development cultural change effort that the agency is undertaking that was discussed yesterday in our first day of testimony. And my colleague Rex Emery is going to be talking about each of these levels. So you'll get a little bit more information about what we mean with each of these levels. But of note, the foundation of our culture is safety and security, both of our physical safety and security, but also emotional and psychological safety and security. And the reason why this becomes so important to us is that we are dealing with a population whose brains are continuing to develop, in some cases to the mid-20s. And there's a couple of structures in the brain that I wanted to call attention to for a moment. And one is that little lima bean-shaped purple part of the brain called the amygdala. And that develops first in the teenage brain, and it's where all of our emotions are. It's the emotional command center, which is why all those teenagers are running around with all their crazy emotions. And the prefrontal cortex is the front region of the brain, which develops a little bit later. And we can credit all of our reasoning, decision-making, and self-control to that prefrontal cortex. So teens don't necessarily have all of their reasoning capabilities and judgment as early as we would like them to have, which tends to result in some pretty impulsive behavior at times, particularly in emotionally charged situations. I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about this particular study where researchers were interested in looking at how teenagers and adults visually process facial expression. And they were asked to take a look at different facial expressions, and they watched which regions of the brain were functioning in a younger brain versus an adult brain. And what you see on the left-hand side is the teen brain, where that little lima bean amygdala is the one that is kind of working overtime. And in the right side, you see the prefrontal cortex is the one that's working to evaluate those facial expressions. And so not only are adolescents using the emotional part of their brain to evaluate the facial expressions of other people, but they're also tending to respond more reactively and not slowing down and using that frontal frontal part of the brain for self-control.
Can I ask a question,
Senator Winters?
Is it different between male and female?
Oh, boy. Chair Williamson and Senator Winters, I can look into that for you, but I don't think so.
You mean the ages? Because the other part, you know, the development, there is a difference between the species.
Chair Williamson and Senator Winters, there are certainly socialized capabilities that we know over time. Females tend to be a little bit more
mature.
Skilled socially.
Mm-hmm. Yes, skilled socially.
And,
skilled
and our male socially. Counterparts may not, but you know, the degree to which that's a biological difference versus a socialization difference is part of much debate in the literature.
Okay.
Yeah. That shifts around age 25, though.
The last little bit of information I wanted to share with respect to our culture change is the process that we've put in place to monitor how well we're doing. And just briefly, we call it the quarterly conversation process. It gives us an opportunity to connect with youth and staff on a quarterly basis around each of those levels of the pyramid and how we're doing in those areas and what we might want to focus on. That's up and running in the facilities, and we're about ready to pilot it with our juvenile parole and probation offices. And we've also just completed development of the training of positive human development that will be delivered to all of our existing staff.
Before I let Shannon and Paul go, I just wanted to acknowledge the work that they're doing. There is no other state in the country that has this type of research capacity and doing this type of work. I just wanted to also share with you that Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, that's the federal institution in charge of juvenile justice systems, has asked these folks to help them with the research that they're doing around how to improve the system. So with that, we'll get into the next part of the presentation.
Thank you so much.
Our 10-year strategic plan for facilities, and I'll invite Rex Emery and also Aaron Foltz, who actually co-chaired this effort. Last year, when we presented in 2014, we did not have this thing ready. But again, due to the great work of Rex, his staff, and also Aaron, we were able to present this study to the legislature in September, during the September e-board. With that, you can go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Me first. Co-Chair Williamson, members of the subcommittee, my name is Aaron Foltz. I'm the Chief of Operations for Facility Services at Oregon Youth Authority.
Co-Chair Williamson, members of the subcommittee, my name is Rex Emery. I'm the Facilities Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm responsible for physical plant operations, maintenance, and construction. And I'm going to speak briefly, well, actually about 25 minutes, about our facilities, briefly about physical plant operations in general, and the process for developing the 10-year strategic plan for closed custody facilities, and the plan recommendations for construction improvements. As you're aware, the budget note directed the Youth Authority to develop the 10-year strategic plan for facilities. And for this part of the presentation, we'll review the first part of the budget note and expand on the four directives focused on our facilities physical plants. They're not showing there yet. I'm going to start rolling them out. So the first directive really set the stage, and it's our current state, which was to evaluate our facilities in terms of capacity, operating and maintenance cost, and deferred maintenance. OYA has 10 closed custody facilities around the state, 96 buildings, 762,000 square feet of building space valued at $191 million. The maintenance operations budget is $10.6 million for biennium, and our deferred maintenance backlog is about $17.5 million. The work of the physical plant operations department is mission informed. First, we protect the public by providing secure physical environment. Next, we ensure that our facilities are in good working order for the staff and youth that occupy them. And finally, the heart of our mission, we strive to provide safe, treatment-oriented spaces that are conducive to the reformation of the youth in our custody. This orders our spending priorities. Projects that resolve immediate safety and security issues are always completed first. In fact, it's our most important performance measure for my department that we report out quarterly at our quarterly target reviews. Next, our funding, the majority of it goes to routine building maintenance. And after that, higher cost projects, roofs, building envelope, HVAC, mechanical systems work is often deferred or temporarily repaired until we can fund the work. And then cosmetic improvements, flooring, paint, and tile, updating old fixtures, restroom and kitchen fixtures ultimately become the lowest priorities. This context is important because building condition is where we started in responding to the budget note. It's especially relevant because along with not being able to update major things like long overdue roof replacements or building interiors, and especially our building interiors, at McLaren, they're run down, dark, and in many cases have gone 50 years without major renovations and are past what is generally considered a typical lifespan of a building interior. OYA now has a plan to address these needs with construction projects that will resolve deferred maintenance and update interior spaces in all buildings that are to be renovated. It brings buildings up to modern seismic codes. And it focuses our renovations to more closely align environments within OIA's culture of positive human development and the Youth Reformation System and national best practices. And it will ensure that the final buildings are functional and flexible for future use. And last, are sustainable and constructed to state energy efficient design standards, continuing the progress made. We started in 2007, where today we've reduced agency usage by 30%. What we've accomplished. We've completed the 10-year plan. Initially, OYA began this work in-house with stakeholder groups, facility superintendents, our treatment staff, OYA cabinet, business services people, and line staff. And together we identified what we considered to be the best ideal space configuration for effective juvenile rehabilitation programs. And we made side-by-side comparisons of each facility to compare the positive and the negative attributes of each. Next, we decided that the plan should be influenced and completed by third-party subject matter experts. In June, we engaged DLR Group Architecture of Portland and Chin Planning of Columbia, South Carolina, to help us finish this process and produce the final 10-year facilities plan. DLR Group is a national architectural and planning firm that specializes in correctional facility design. And Chin Planning is a national leader in juvenile justice programming and design and has assisted other states in updating their programs using evidence-based design industry standards. DLR Group and Chin Planning toured representative OYA facilities and engaged staff via interviews to assess the functionality and condition of our facilities. Quoting from the plan, the key issues affecting OYA facilities are physical, age and condition, environmental, access to daylight, views, appropriate finishes, and safety provided by seismic upgrades, and programmatic, access to the right types and configurations of spaces for programs such as treatment, recreation, housing, visitation, education, and vocational programs. They highlighted our significant building condition needs, including remedying the backlog of deferred maintenance work and updating old and deteriorating buildings, some of which date back nearly 60 years, and were built with a mid-century institutional framework. Also noted in the report was that the regional facilities, those are the facilities other than Hillcrest and McLaren, were built in response to sentencing changes approved by voters in the early 1990s, and they resemble boot camp-like detention compounds. Using their expertise and experience, through their perspective of comparable national best practices, the consultants helped us improve our list of ideal juvenile justice building design features, which could be incorporated into renovation and construction projects. Recommendation and rationale for facility disposition. The 10-year strategic plan recommends that the state invests $97.4 million over 10 years in its facilities. The initial phasing and projects will be geared to consolidate the two Valley Youth Correctional Facilities, Hillcrest and McLaren, into one campus in Woodburn at McLaren. The Hillcrest facility in Salem would be sold by July 2017. However, prior to that, major construction will have to take place at McLaren. We'll have to renovate the facility's dilapidated living units, renovate and build statewide intake processing that's currently located at Hillcrest, and relocate a mental health housing unit for younger males, also located at Hillcrest. The other part of phase one is renovations at our Grants Pass facility, Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility and our only women's facility. Our girls' facility is in Albany. It's Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility. Future uses of buildings and buildings no longer needed. We'll repurpose and renovate existing facilities where possible to save on construction costs. The plan will also demolish 5 buildings at McLaren that are past their service life. And as mentioned, after updating buildings at McLaren and moving youth and staff from Hillcrest to McLaren, we'll sell Hillcrest. Okay. The pyramid. You've already seen...
Representative Barker.
And, you know, I'm just... Where I went to high school, my high school would build a house, and they still do that. And so are you able to use any of these people in, like, a vocational training and have them actually do some of the construction work? I don't want to take away from free people and their jobs, but it would seem to me like this would be a great chance to integrate some really hands-on training for these young men and women. I don't know if you're allowed to do that. I don't know what the restrictions might be, but I just was wondering about that.
Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Barker. Yes, we do use youth. Actually, youth get to participate in vocational programs at all of our facilities. They work with the trades maintenance workers. As far as larger construction projects, we're very careful about competing with the local contractors. However, some contractors in the past have allowed us to involve our youth in varying degrees on projects. And we'll certainly involve some of the higher level youth in some of the design process. That'll occur internally, and then we'll certainly look. It won't be a bidding requirement, but we'll certainly look at successful bidders to see who might be interested in allowing some of the higher level youth to participate.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the positive human development pyramid. I'm going to show how using the pyramid levels, how positive human development can be incorporated into building design elements for construction projects. So safety and security is the foundation of it all. Elements that support an environment where youth and staff are physically safe include physical plant considerations for noise levels, temperature, lighting, seismic stability, cleanliness, abatement of hazardous building materials, asbestos and lead, suicide-resistant physical spaces, relieve space overloading by reducing housing densities from 25 to 16 beds per living unit, and our security technology program and compliance with the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Whenever we make modifications to camera systems, whenever we do building design, we always consider the effect on design on the agency's ability to protect youth from sexual abuse. Elements that support emotional safety and security. Windows and doors that allow natural light to enter spaces and are free of bars and gives visual access to the outdoors. Interior finishes, including paint and flooring, are therapeutic and not sterile and are in good condition. High ceilings to provide a sense of openness and a wide horizon view that helps youth look outward to new opportunities instead of being enclosed in a room or behind 20-foot high gray walls. The next tier is caring and supportive relationships. Elements that support positive and staff-youth interaction include a floor plan that allows staff to position themselves in the youth's living areas and allows for direct interactions with youth to model and apply healthy relational behavior. Open living areas will allow youth to see staff and vice versa, and access to inviting and secure common areas to foster and practice positive social interactions. The next tier, high expectations and accountability. Youth care for and maintain their homes. These are common areas on units and within the facilities that are easy to clean and are made from durable materials. Program areas off unit, including outdoor areas for treatment, program re-regulation, skill building, de-escalation, and facility operation support. Building elements to engage youth in reformation. Rooms for treatment or groups on units, outdoor space for physical fitness and participation in team sports, and areas outside their living unit for classroom education to give youth the more normalized experience of going to school, complete with all the expectations that accompany participating in educational programs. and for work experience, learning skills, and developing the discipline needed to support future employment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winters.
A question. Did you consider, and I'm going to look at, since you're talking about renovation and you're able to come up with some things maybe that was on your wish list that you might not have been able to do before, and I'm thinking in terms of your vocational center and whether or not that's an opportunity to expand that with the merger into McLaren. And I'm also looking at, when you talk about athletics and sports, whether you're able to actually take that and build on that so that, you know, you're able to actually do a lot more. I think these are opportunities as you begin to talk about the merger from the Hillcrest and joining the McLaren campus. And I hope that's a part of the plan design, you know, as you go forward, because I do think it's opportunities when we talk about, you know, our building instruction design. Because sometimes, and I don't know what other states are doing, and I don't really kind of care what other states are doing. What I do care is what we do and our plan forward to make certain that we're remembering all those particular facets, you know, as we talk about juveniles and children inside of your facilities. I see Fairbairn, so I know he's going to comment.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, you remember, I know you remember, prior to Measure 11, we had no fence around McLaren.
I do.
We had extensive athletic programs. In fact, local high schools came in and competed against our teams from McLaren. Unfortunately, after Measure 11, what has happened is that we abandoned a lot of those practices because we cannot allow DOC youth outside the fence. This new plan provides for recreational opportunities for youth as well as sport opportunities for youth. We are actually looking at some innovative programs, and we are running a little bit short of time. So what I'd like to do is just give Erin an opportunity to share with you what this physical plan does as far as aligning with how we want to deal with our youth, because everything that you're seeing here today is actually aligning with what Shannon and Paul shared with you around brain development, around, you know, getting the youth in a mindset so that they can develop appropriately so that we could have fewer future crimes.
Thank you. You took the words out of my mouth. We have just shy of 15 minutes, and Art, we'll probably have you start tomorrow, so you're off the hook for today. Go ahead.
Co-chairs Williamson and Shields, members of the subcommittee. I would say in a nutshell that the 10-year plan helps align our physical plant with what we know is most supportive and effective for helping youth or adolescent brains develop in a healthy way. And so I think that what we are looking for in our 10-year plan is to develop spaces that allow the most normalized environments that we know support that healthy brain development. So things like Rex was talking about and like Senator Winters pointed out, spaces for athletic activities and recreational activities, but beyond that, just outdoor space where youth can be when they need to have a place to re-regulate, take space away from a group. Most adolescents don't grow up in an environment with 20 other youth all the time. Having individualized rooms that are like bedrooms, which is the normal adolescent experience. So I think that our hope is that by providing that environment, we can kind of create and foster that development more effectively in youth in our care.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move to the next slide, just in the interest of time. So DLR Group and Chin Planning, this is a quote right out of the report, and we thought it was important enough to share. The current mix of facilities within OYA's system does not support the vision, mission, and culture of OYA. Housing and living units reflect the most serious gap between vision and reality. The majority of youth are housed with long lengths of stay in densely populated dormitory living units. Program and treatment space is not adequate to support relief and breakout space. The 10-year strategic plan recommendations.
It recommends that the state invest $97.4 million over the next decade for the capital renewal work, an initial investment of $1.2 million this biennium for preliminary design and planning purposes, and $47.9 million for phase one beginning this biennium, 2015, and $48.3 million for phase two projects beginning 2017 biennium. So these are some photographs of McLaren. This is the interior of one of the living units, one of the eight front cottages. This is a patio area on those same front cottages. And these are pictures inside our gear complex. These are individual rooms, and these are areas we use for dormitories. And this is a typical 1950s restroom, shower room in our gear compound.
So let's not go. There are actually a series of maps that are provided. We are not going to go through them. But, you know, this is basically out of the 10-year plan that shows the existing structure and what is to be constructed and, you know, how is this transition going to take place. Because, frankly, closing Hillcrest is a big deal. And you know, in order to do that and move the population to McLaren, as Rex said earlier, we have to provide an adequate intake center, because intake becomes really one of the most important aspects of the youth contact with OYA. That's the very first time that they get to learn about the organization and what our expectations are, so we need to have that functioning. There are also a series of photographs from Rogue Valley Correctional Facility, again, the map that shows the recreation field that we're trying to develop there. There are some pictures from Oak Creek Correctional Facility. Again, in this phase one, the Oak Creek improvements are minor, but we really do need a separate school building at Oak Creek, and hopefully, you know, in phase two, we can do that. So if Rex, if you can just quickly cover the next slide, the 10-year the next steps, then I'll do my closing and we'll finish on time.
Okay, so in closing, our goal is to continue the momentum. Currently, we're working on engaging architectural firms to begin the design process for McLaren, Rogue Valley, and Oak Creek facilities. We're hoping for legislative approval for a bond authority to begin phase one. We'll release an invitation to bid for an accelerated time frame for the construction work beginning this summer and begin construction work on those three facilities at that time. The goal is to finish phase one by June 30th, 2017, so that we can close Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility.
Thank you, Rex and Aaron. Any questions before we go to final comments? So I, in my opening remarks, I said how proud I am of the staff that do the work for this agency. And, you know, they do the work day in and day out and give their best to produce the best outcome for youth. You've seen numerous examples of that over the course of the past yesterday and today, and you know, some of those practices are actually leading practices in the nation and are being recognized. I personally am extremely blessed to be surrounded by a talented group of people. It's fun to actually be taking credit for the work that they do. You know, and I just want to make sure that everybody knows that this work is not just OYA's work. We collaborate with our county partners. We have great relationship with them. We can't do this work without them, the law enforcement, the judicial system, the courts. This is really a continuum which we are a very small part of. And our entire effort has been to expand that lens, to see this continuum from a wider lens and to partner with everyone to have the best outcome. So what are our challenges? Very quickly. Our biggest challenge is the full implementation of the youth reformation system and the positive human development. This requires a steady focus and resources to complete the work. You might remember, or you might know, that in the beginning of this current biennium, 2% was cut from our budget, which only 0.5% was returned. Now, we had an understanding, Senator Winters, I don't want to say we had a deal. We had an understanding. back then, co-chairs Williamson and Winters, that we were not going to be given any more resources, but we were instructed to move this thing forward with existing resources. That 1.5% cut cost us 13 positions. And, frankly, in my world, positions are much more important than money because they're really hard to come by. Those are the positions that we needed to implement this system. Also, we are going to give up about $2.3 million in this next budget. So those are some of our challenges. Implementing the facilities plan and meeting the timelines. It's a very aggressive timeline for us to close Hillcrest by July of 2017. We need to move fast. We need to have some early bond sales in order to be able to meet that schedule. What that would mean if we don't happen to do that is just that schedule will get delayed. Ultimately, that facility will be closed. We cannot afford to run two mega facilities in the valley with partial capacity. Modernizing JGIS and building the data warehouse. The only reason that we can do these predictive analytics and the research work is because of the data that we have. This is a system that we own collectively with our county partners, and we are not ready yet. But, you might want to light a fire under us by instructing us to come back and report to you next year with a plan to modernize JGIS. And, that really needs to come from our... Sometimes I need a fire under me to get going. So, and finally, taking care of our people. And this is really most important. What we are engaged in is a cultural transformation and a system transformation, and we cannot do it without our frontline staff. This is significant, that we are closing a facility, and we are pushing a culture change, and we have both of our unions in lockstep with us. And that speaks greatly to the quality of our staff and the quality of labor partners that we're dealing with. We have to be able to support our staff, to give them the tool and the training that they need in order to make this transformation possible. Finally, I just want to thank the members of the committee for giving us this opportunity. Both Joe and I are available to meet with you if you have any questions around the presentation. If something comes up later, I know you have this long road ahead of you until the end of the session, and we are available to answer questions as you make your funding decisions.
Senator Winters. And I really appreciate all the work that you've done, and thank you for listening to us when we ramble and bamble on. I do have one request, and you can get it back later and share it with all the members, because it was not mentioned, and I do know that there are challenges, because we talk a lot about recidivism, and we talk about what's happening with reentry. And the one piece that was silent in the presentation is the challenges that our youth encounter in the educational system. And so if you would report back, not lengthy, what some of those challenges are. I understand that you have some individuals returning back to their community who are not even admitted into the high schools. I think that's abominable. But anyway, that's just my own private thoughts. And if you're listening, education, because we have some expectations of individuals have served their time and they're going back home. So if you would get those for us, I would appreciate it and share it with the other members of this panel.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Winters, we will get that information for you.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to let you know that I am incredibly impressed with the presentation that you all have put together. The use of data by Shannon and Dr. Bilotti, who I have the utmost respect for, I think is exactly the direction that we need to be going. And I just wanted to congratulate you. Thank you for telling us what you need, and hopefully we won't be telling you how to get along without it.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shields.
And of course,
that would be bad. Well, again, did I say that out loud? Anyway, I also want to thank you for the presentation, and I've been very impressed by the staff that has come before us or has come to visit. The one thing, too, that I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in all of this, I see a recognition that it isn't just seismic that we have to worry about, and it's not just old stuff that we have to worry about, but it's the psychological impact on on the youth that we're serving. I think too often we forget that piece. And I think, to go back to something Senator Winter said, education perhaps could learn a few things, because when you're running schools that are dilapidated, there's a psychological impact there as well. So I applaud your efforts in that respect.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, and just for the record, Hillcrest is in my district. However, having said that, I totally support the 10-year plan, because not only do I believe that it is an efficient and effective way to go, the numbers and the work that staff have done to lay out the case for it is on target. So in case anyone is wondering where the senator is on this plan, she is supportive of the plan.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Well, thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5542. And we are adjourned. Hearing on Senate Bill 5542.